Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day and pray that you'll be with us today as we study your word. And we ask also that you'll be with us through this new year. Hear our prayers and we pray that you'll take care of us. Thank you for this time that we have together. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, today we're just going to jump right into it, but we're going to talk about psychoanalysis, and we're going to talk about sex.
Happy New Year!
Now that we sort of got that out of the way, I think what you'll find is, I mean, he's got some really great things to say about sexual morality and speaking into, you know, what we deal with today. In sort of sexual mores, where people say Christians are repressed, and you know, the reason that we have so many problems is because we don't talk about sex. We don't, you know, we're holding back in our Victorian society, and he deals with that accusation, and then he moves on to how a Christian needs to handle that sin in that area. And it turns out to be that when you sin, you ask forgiveness and you move forward. And then when you sin again, you trust God that he forgives, and you ask forgiveness, and you work on it, and you move forward. And you'll hear that theme today, which I think is a great thing, particularly for young men in this area. A very encouraging piece. Psychoanalysis is the first area that he's talking about, and basically what he's trying to do is remove the Freudianism that's crept in. And he's saying, look, there is sickness out there where people's raw material is messed up. And so you might need a doctor or a psychologist to come in and fix that. Morality deals with the free choices that we make and the wrong choice. When we make wrong choices, that's sin. And that's what the Christian thought is dealing with, is that. Yes, Freud, when he talks about neurological problems, he's an authority, but as soon as he, and we'll hear this C.S. Lewis say this, when he moves off into philosophy, which is something that C.S. Lewis knows about, Freud is not competent. And so he divides that out and makes that clear. And then he says, every time you make a choice, you're turning to the central part of you, the part of you that chooses, you're turning that part into something a little different than what it was before. He's talking about the Christian life as we move forward through our Christian life. And we make choices, and we make mistakes, and we ask forgiveness, and then we try to do better, and we work on it, and we make choices that are good, and then we fail again, and we ask forgiveness, and we move forward. And taking your life as a whole, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing either into a heavenly creature or a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else into one that is in a state of war and hatred with God and with his fellow creatures and with itself. The right direction leads not only to peace but to knowledge. So what he's really talking about is what it says in Romans 8, where it says where he's making us more like Christ. That's this process that we're going through is somehow sanctifying us and moving us toward heaven, or being more heavenly creatures. So let's listen to that first one, and then we'll talk a little more about the sexual morality here.
To religious matters, for the longest way... 4. Morality and psychoanalysis. I have said that we should never get a Christian society unless most of us became Christian individuals. That does not mean, of course, that we can put off doing anything about society until some imaginary date in the far future. It means that we must begin both jobs at once. 1. The job of seeing how do as you would be done by can be applied in detail to modern society. And 2. The job of becoming the sort of people who really would apply it if we saw how. I now want to begin considering what the Christian idea of a good man is. The Christian specification for the human machine. Before I come down to details, there are 2 more general points I should like to make. First of all, since Christian morality claims to be a technique for putting the human machine right, I think you would like to know how it is related to another technique which seems to make a similar claim, namely, psychoanalysis. Now, you want to distinguish very clearly between 2 things. Between the actual medical theories and technique of the psychoanalysts and the general philosophical view of the world which Freud and some others have gone on to add to this. The second thing, the philosophy of Freud, is in direct contradiction to the other great psychologist, Jung. And furthermore, when Freud is talking about how to cure neurotics, he is speaking as a specialist on his own subject. But when he goes on to talk general philosophy, he is speaking as an amateur. It is therefore quite sensible to attend to him with respect in the one case and not in the other. And that is what I do. I am all the readier to do it, because I have found that when he is talking off his own subject and on a subject I do know something about, namely language, he is very ignorant. But psychoanalysis itself, apart from all the philosophical additions that Freud and others have made to it, is not in the least contradictory to Christianity. Its technique overlaps with Christian morality at some points, and it would not be a bad thing if every person knew something about it. But it does not run the same course all the way, for the 2 techniques are doing rather different things. When a man makes a moral choice, 2 things are involved. 1 is the act of choosing. The other is the various feelings, impulses, and so on, which his psychological outfit presents him with, and which are the raw material of his choice. Now, this raw material may be of 2 kinds. Either it may be what we would call normal, it may consist of the sort of feelings that are common to all men, or else it may consist of quite unnatural feelings due to things that have gone wrong in his subconscious. Thus, fear of things that are really dangerous would be an example of the first kind. An irrational fear of cats or spiders would be an example of the second kind. The desire of a man for a woman would be of the first kind. The perverted desire of a man for a man would be of the second. Now, what psychoanalysis undertakes to do is to remove the abnormal feelings, that is, to give the man better raw material for his acts of choice. Morality is concerned with the acts of choice themselves. Put it this way. Imagine 3 men who go to a war. One has the ordinary natural fear of danger that any man has, and he subdues it by moral effort and becomes a brave man. Let us suppose that the other 2 have, as a result of things in their subconscious, exaggerated, irrational fears, which no amount of moral effort can do anything about. Now suppose that a psychoanalyst comes along and cures these 2. That is, he puts them both back in the position of the first man. Well, it is just then that the psychoanalytical problem is over and the moral problem begins. Because now that they are cured, these 2 men might take quite different lines. The first might say, "Thank goodness I've got rid of all those doodahs. Now at last I can do what I always wanted to do, my duty to my country." But the other might say, "Well, I'm very glad that I now feel moderately cool under fire, but of course that doesn't alter the fact that I'm still jolly well determined to look after number 1 and let the other chap do the dangerous job whenever I can. Indeed, one of the good things about feeling less frightened is that I can now look after myself much more efficiently and can be much cleverer at hiding the fact from the others." Now, this difference is a purely moral one, and psychoanalysis cannot do anything about it. However much you improve the man's raw material, you have still got something else. The real free choice of the man on the material presented to him, either to put his own advantage first or to put it last. And this free choice is the only thing that morality is concerned with. The bad psychological material is not a sin, but a disease. It does not need to be repented of, but to be cured. And, by the way, that is very important. Human beings judge one another by their external actions. God judges them by their moral choices. When a neurotic who has a pathological horror of cats forces himself to pick up a cat for some good reason, it is quite possible that in God's eyes he has shown more courage than a healthy man may have shown in winning the VC. When a man who has been perverted from his youth and taught that cruelty is the right thing does some tiny little kindness, or refrains from some cruelty he might have committed and thereby perhaps risks being sneered at by his companions, he may, in God's eyes, be doing more than you and I would do if we gave up life itself for a friend. It is as well to put this the other way round. Some of us who seem quite nice people may, in fact, have made so little use of a good heredity and a good upbringing that we are really worse than those whom we regard as fiends. Can we be quite certain how we should have behaved if we had been saddled with the psychological outfit, and then with the bad upbringing, and then with the power, say, of Himmler? That is why Christians are told not to judge. We see only the results which a man's choices make out of his raw material. But God does not judge him on the raw material at all, but on what he has done with it. Most of the man's psychological makeup is probably due to his body. When his body dies, all that will fall off him. And the real, central man, the thing that chose, that made the best or the worst out of this material, will stand naked. All sorts of nice things which we thought our own, but which were really due to a good digestion, will fall off some of us. All sorts of nasty things which were due to complexes or bad health will fall off others. We shall then, for the first time, see everyone as he really was. There will be surprises. And that leads on to my second point. People often think of Christian morality as a kind of bargain in which God says, if you keep a lot of rules, I'll reward you, and if you don't, I'll do the other thing. I do not think that is the best way of looking at it. I would much rather say that every time you make a choice, you are turning the central part of you, the part of you that chooses, into something a little different from what it was before. And taking your life as a whole, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else into one that is in a state of war and hatred with God and with its fellow creatures and with itself. To be the one kind of creature is heaven. That is, it is joy and peace and knowledge and power. To be the other means madness, horror, idiocy, rage, impotence, and eternal loneliness. Each of us at each moment is progressing to the one state or the other. That explains what always used to puzzle me about Christian writers. They seem to be so very strict at one moment and so very free and easy at another. They talk about mere sins of thought as if they were immensely important. And then they talk about the most frightful murders and treacheries as if you'd only got to repent and all would be forgiven. But I have come to see that they are right. What they are always thinking of is the mark which the action leaves on that tiny central self which no one sees in this life, but which each of us will have to endure or enjoy forever. One man may be so placed that his anger sheds the blood of thousands, and another so placed that however angry he gets, he will only be laughed at. But the little mark on the soul may be much the same in both. Each has done something to himself which, unless he repents, will make it hard for him to keep out the rage next time he is tempted, and will make the rage worse when he does fall into it. Each of them, if he seriously turns to God, can have that twist in the central man straightened out again. Each is, in the long run, doomed if he will not. The bigness or smallness of the thing, seen from the outside, is not what really matters. One last point. Remember that, as I said, the right direction leads not only to peace, but to knowledge. When a man is getting better, he understands more and more clearly the evil that is still left in him. When a man is getting worse, he understands his own badness less and less. A moderately bad man knows he is not very good. A thoroughly bad man thinks he is all right. This is common sense, really. You understand sleep when you are awake, not while you are sleeping. You can see mistakes in arithmetic when your mind is working properly. While you are making them, you cannot see them. You can understand the nature of drunkenness when you are sober, not when you are drunk. Good people know about both good and evil. Bad people do not know about either. 5. Sexual morality.
Okay. So, you did see him talking about sanctification in here. He's just saying there's sickness and there's choice. And the Christian morality is dealing with our free choices. And so taking away the confusion of psychoanalysis, and then talks about our Christian life, talks about sanctification. Moving then on into sexual morality, he makes a couple of statements. He says, modern people are always saying, sex is nothing to be ashamed of. Right? It's nothing to be ashamed of. And it's true if what we're saying is, there's nothing to be ashamed of in the fact that the human race reproduces itself in that way, nor in the fact that it gives pleasure. Christianity defends that. Christianity is the one religion that says that the body is good. Matter is good. God made the body. And he made the soul. And we're not just spiritual creatures, but we also live in a tangible world with a body. And when we go to heaven, we will have a body. We're not going to be soulless creatures sitting on a cloud playing a harp for eternity. But we will have a body, and we will be on earth as it is renewed, and we will live the way God intended it to be, which I think is somewhat like the Garden of Eden. Okay, so sex is good, and it's not something to be ashamed of when you're talking about it in that way. Okay, very Christian. But sex is, if you mean sex is nothing to be ashamed of, meaning the state into which the sexual instinct has now got is nothing to be ashamed of. The way we think about it today, where it's on TV, it's everywhere, and we want to say, hey, it is a natural, healthy, reasonable thing to have sex anytime you want. And you can't tell me that two consenting adults, whether they're married or not, you can't tell me that that's wrong. There's, you know, if I'm looking at pictures or seeing a striptease, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? Well, the Christian view is that there is something wrong with that. And C.S. Lewis, in a very clever way, kind of goes and points that out. And then he gets into what we Christians need to be doing in terms of sexual morality, and that is, when we fail, we ask God to forgive us, and we keep trying. And in so doing, like he said in the chapter we just listened to, we become more heavenly creatures. We become sanctified. We become more like Christ. And then his final point in the chapter is that the central wrong that Christianity focuses on is not sex or illicit sex or problems that people have with being tempted in this way. He's saying that's not the central wrong. There are others that he considers to be worse. With sex, it is dealing just with the body. But there are other wrongs, like, and here's what he says, all the worst pleasures are really spiritual, like the pleasure of putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiling sport, and backbiting, the pleasures of power, of hatred. For these are two things inside me competing with the human self, which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worst of the two, the self that is dealing with those spiritual wrongs. So he's saying, look, there are all kinds of sins, and this one that we emphasize so much, immorality, is not the central wrong. It is one of many. Okay? So I found it to be a very good and comforting chapter. Let's listen to it.
We must now consider Christian morality as regards sex, what Christians call the virtue of chastity. The Christian rule of chastity must not be confused with the social rule of modesty, in one sense of that word, i.e. propriety or decency. The social rule of propriety lays down how much of the human body should be displayed and what subjects can be referred to and in what words, according to the customs of a given social circle. Thus, while the rule of chastity is the same for all Christians at all times, the rule of propriety changes. A girl in the Pacific Islands wearing hardly any clothes and a Victorian lady completely covered in clothes might both be equally modest, proper, or decent, according to the standards of their own societies. And both, for all we could tell by their dress, might be equally chaste or equally unchaste. Some of the language which chaste women used in Shakespeare's time would have been used in the 19th century only by a woman completely abandoned. When people break the rule of propriety current in their own time and place, if they do so in order to excite lust in themselves or others, then they are offending against chastity. But if they break it through ignorance or carelessness, they are guilty only of bad manners. When, as often happens, they break it defiantly in order to shock or embarrass others, they are not necessarily being unchaste, but they are being uncharitable. For it is uncharitable to take pleasure in making other people uncomfortable. I do not think that a very strict or fussy standard of propriety is any proof of chastity or any help to it. And I therefore regard the great relaxation and simplifying of the rule which has taken place in my own lifetime as a good thing. At its present stage, however, it has this inconvenience, that people of different ages and different types do not all acknowledge the same standard, and we hardly know where we are. While this confusion lasts, I think that old or old-fashioned people should be very careful not to assume that young or emancipated people are corrupt whenever they are, by the old standard, improper. And in return, that young people should not call their elders prudes or puritans because they do not easily adopt the new standard. A real desire to believe all the good you can of others and to make others as comfortable as you can will solve most of the problems. Chastity is the most unpopular of the Christian virtues. There is no getting away from it. The Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. Now, this is so difficult and so contrary to our instincts that obviously either Christianity is wrong, or our sexual instinct, as it now is, has gone wrong. One or the other. Of course, being a Christian, I think it is the instinct which has gone wrong. But I have other reasons for thinking so. The biological purpose of sex is children, just as the biological purpose of eating is to repair the body. Now, if we eat whenever we feel inclined, and just as much as we want, it is quite true most of us will eat too much, but not terrifically too much. One man may eat enough for two, but he does not eat enough for 10. The appetite goes a little beyond its biological purpose, but not enormously. But if a healthy young man indulged his sexual appetite whenever he felt inclined, and if each act produced a baby, then in 10 years he might easily populate a small village. This appetite is in ludicrous and preposterous excess of its function. Or take it another way. You can get a large audience together for a striptease act. That is, to watch a girl undress on the stage. Now, suppose you come to a country where you could fill a theatre by simply bringing a covered plate onto the stage and then slowly lifting the cover so as to let everyone see, just before the lights went out, that it contained a mutton chop or a bit of bacon. Would you not think that in that country something had gone wrong with the appetite for food? And would not anyone who had grown up in a different world think there was something equally queer about the state of the sex instinct among us? One critic said that if he found a country in which such striptease acts with food were popular, he would conclude that the people of that country were starving. He meant, of course, to imply that such things as the striptease act resulted not from sexual corruption, but from sexual starvation. I agree with him that if in some strange land we found that similar acts with mutton chops were popular, one of the possible explanations which would occur to me would be famine. But the next step would be to test our hypothesis by finding out whether, in fact, much or little food was being consumed in that country. If the evidence showed that a good deal was being eaten, then of course we should have to abandon the hypothesis of starvation and try to think of another one. In the same way, before accepting sexual starvation as the cause of the striptease, we should have to look for evidence that there is in fact more sexual abstinence in our age than in those ages when things like the striptease were unknown. But surely there is no such evidence. Contraceptives have made sexual indulgence far less costly within marriage and far safer outside it than ever before. And public opinion is less hostile to illicit unions and even to perversion than it has been since pagan times. Nor is the hypothesis of starvation the only one we can imagine. Everyone knows that the sexual appetite, like our other appetites, grows by indulgence. Starving men may think much about food, but so do gluttons. The gorged as well as the famished like titillations. Here is the third point. You find very few people who want to eat things that really are not food or to do other things with food instead of eating it. In other words, perversions of the food appetite are rare. But perversions of the sex instinct are numerous, hard to cure, and frightful. I'm sorry to have to go into all these details, but I must. The reason why I must is that you and I, for the last 20 years, have been fed all day long on good solid lies about sex. We have been told, till one is sick of hearing it, that sexual desire is in the same state as any of our other natural desires, and that if only we abandon the silly old Victorian idea of hushing it up, everything in the garden will be lovely. It is not true. The moment you look at the facts and away from the propaganda, you see that it is not. They tell you sex has become a mess because it was hushed up. But for the last 20 years, it has not been. It has been chattered about all day long. Yet it is still in a mess. If hushing up had been the cause of the trouble, ventilation would have set it right. But it has not. I think it is the other way around. I think the human race originally hushed it up because it had become such a mess. Modern people are always saying, sex is nothing to be ashamed of. They may mean two things. They may mean there is nothing to be ashamed of in the fact that the human race reproduces itself in a certain way, nor in the fact that it gives pleasure. If they mean that, they are right. Christianity says the same. It is not the thing, nor the pleasure, that is the trouble. The old Christian teachers said that if man had never fallen, sexual pleasure, instead of being less than it is now, would actually have been greater. I know some muddle-headed Christians have talked as if Christianity thought that sex, or the body, or pleasure, were bad in themselves. But they were wrong. Christianity is almost the only one of the great religions which thoroughly approves of the body, which believes that matter is good, that God himself once took on a human body, that some kind of body is going to be given to us even in heaven and is going to be an essential part of our happiness or beauty and our energy. Christianity has glorified marriage more than any other religion, and nearly all the greatest love poetry in the world has been produced by Christians. If anyone says that sex in itself is bad, Christianity contradicts him at once. But of course, when people say sex is nothing to be ashamed of, they may mean the state into which the sexual instinct has now got is nothing to be ashamed of. If they mean that, I think they are wrong. I think it is everything to be ashamed of. There is nothing to be ashamed of in enjoying your food. There would be everything to be ashamed of if half the world made food the main interest of their lives and spent their time looking at pictures of food and dribbling and smacking their lips. I do not say you and I are individually responsible for the present situation. Our ancestors have handed over to us organisms which are warped in this respect. And we grow up surrounded by propaganda in favour of unchastity. There are people who want to keep our sex instinct inflamed in order to make money out of us. Because, of course, a man with an obsession is a man who has very little sales resistance. God knows our situation. He will not judge us as if we had no difficulties to overcome. What matters is the sincerity and perseverance of our will to overcome them. Before we can be cured, we must want to be cured. Those who really wish for help will get it. But for many modern people, even the wish is difficult. It is easy to think that we want something when we do not really want it. A famous Christian long ago told us that when he was a young man, he prayed constantly for chastity. But years later, he realized that while his lips had been saying, "O Lord, make me chaste," his heart had been secretly adding, "But please don't do it just yet." This may happen in prayers for other virtues too, but there are three reasons why it is now specially difficult for us to desire, let alone to achieve, complete chastity. In the first place, our warped natures, the devils who tempt us, and all the contemporary propaganda for lust combine to make us feel that the desires we are resisting are so natural, so healthy, and so reasonable that it is almost perverse and abnormal to resist them. Poster after poster, film after film, novel after novel associate the idea of sexual indulgence with the ideas of health, normality, youth, frankness, and good humour. Now this association is a lie. Like all powerful lies, it is based on a truth. The truth, acknowledged above, that sex in itself, apart from the excesses and obsessions that have grown round it, is normal and healthy and all the rest of it. The lie consists in the suggestion that any sexual act to which you are tempted at the moment is also healthy and normal. Now this, on any conceivable view, and quite apart from Christianity, must be nonsense. Surrender to all our desires obviously leads to impotence, disease, jealousies, lies, concealment, and everything that is the reverse of health, good humour, and frankness. For any happiness, even in this world, quite a lot of restraint is going to be necessary. So the claim made by every desire, when it is strong, to be healthy and reasonable, counts for nothing. Every sane and civilized man must have some set of principles by which he chooses to reject some of his desires and to permit others. One man does this on Christian principles, another on hygienic principles, another on sociological principles. The real conflict is not between Christianity and nature, but between Christian principles and other principles in the control of nature. For nature, in the sense of natural desire, will have to be controlled anyway, unless you are going to ruin your whole life. The Christian principles are, admittedly, stricter than the others, but then we think you will get help towards obeying them, which you will not get towards obeying the others. In the second place, many people are deterred from seriously attempting Christian chastity because they think, before trying, that it is impossible. But when a thing has to be attempted, one must never think about possibility or impossibility. Faced with an optional question in an examination paper, one considers whether one can do it or not. Faced with a compulsory question, one must do the best one can. You may get some marks for a very imperfect answer. You will certainly get none for leaving the question alone. Not only in examinations, but in war, in mountain climbing, in learning to skate or swim or ride a bicycle, even in fastening a stiff collar with cold fingers. People quite often do what seemed impossible before they did it. It is wonderful what you can do when you have to. We may indeed be sure that perfect chastity, like perfect charity, will not be attained by any merely human efforts. You must ask for God's help. Even when you have done so, it may seem to you for a long time that no help, or less help than you need, is being given. Never mind. After each failure, ask forgiveness, pick yourself up, and try again. Very often what God first helps us towards is not the virtue itself, but just this power of always trying again. For however important chastity, or courage, or truthfulness, or any other virtue may be, this process trains us in habits of the soul which are more important still. It cures our illusions about ourselves and teaches us to depend on God. We learn, on the one hand, that we cannot trust ourselves even in our best moments, and on the other, that we need not despair even in our worst. For our failures are forgiven. The only fatal thing is to sit down content with anything less than perfection. Thirdly, people often misunderstand what psychology teaches about repressions. It teaches us that repressed sex is dangerous. But repressed is here a technical term. It does not mean suppressed in the sense of denied or resisted. A repressed desire or thought is one which has been thrust into the subconscious, usually at a very early age, and can now come before the mind only in a disguised and unrecognizable form. Repressed sexuality does not appear to the patient to be sexuality at all. When an adolescent or an adult is engaged in resisting a conscious desire, he is not dealing with a repression, nor is he in the least danger of creating a repression. On the contrary, those who are seriously attempting chastity are more conscious and soon know a great deal more about their own sexuality than anyone else. They come to know their desires as Wellington knew Napoleon or as Sherlock Holmes knew Moriarty, as a rat catcher knows rats or a plumber knows about leaky pipes. Virtue, even attempted virtue, brings light. Indulgence brings fog. Finally, though I have had to speak at some length about sex, I want to make it as clear as I possibly can that the centre of Christian morality is not here. If anyone thinks that Christians regard unchastity as the supreme vice, he is quite wrong. The sins of the flesh are bad, but they are the least bad of all sins. All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual. the pleasure of putting other people in the wrong, of bossing and patronizing and spoiling sport and backbiting, the pleasures of power, of hatred. For there are two things inside me, competing with the human self which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worse of the two. That is why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. But of course, it is better to be neither. 6.
So there's a lot there, don't you think? I mean, what to even focus on? I mean, I'm going to go right to the heart of it and sanctification. Whether it's sex or any other sin, we fail. Okay, and the whole going back to the very beginning of all this, the problem that we have is that there is a law of right behavior that we know is there that we haven't created ourselves. It's some pressure that's on us, and we fall short of it, and we know it. We all know it. And Christianity gives us a way of escape. It allows us to ask forgiveness, be at peace with God, and work on it. So, you know, the sin of immorality, pornography, being tempted in this way, particularly for young men, is a struggle. And it's more of a struggle today given all the influences that we have. He's telling us how to deal with that sin. And the way to deal with it is ask God for help. And even when you've done so, it may seem to you for a long time that no help or less help than you need is being given. Never mind. Never mind. After each failure, ask forgiveness. Pick yourself up and try again. And very often, what God first helps us towards is not the virtue itself, but just the power of always trying again. For however important chastity or any other things, courage, truthfulness, any other virtue, may be, this process trains us in habits of the soul which are more important still. Let's see. I wanted us to read what he says right after that, too. Okay. This, for our ever important chastity, may be this process trains us in habits of the soul which are more important still. It cures our illusions about ourselves and teaches us to depend on God. We learn on the one hand that we cannot trust ourselves even in our best moments, and on the other that we need to despair, that we need not despair in our worst, for our failures are forgiven. The only fatal thing is to sit down content with anything less than perfection. Okay? And then the last paragraph that he says is, you know, immorality is not the only sin. There are so many others. There's backbiting. There's gossip. There's all these other things. And we fail there too. And when we do, we should ask for help. We should ask for forgiveness and push forward. And that is sanctification. That's becoming more like Christ. And this process that we go through, dealing with sin, failing, and moving forward, makes us more like Christ as we go. Don't relax and don't be satisfied with imperfection. Keep after it. keep calling on God. But when you fail, don't despair. Ask for forgiveness and go forward. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a piece of that you said about moving forward. I think it's probably the most important thing there, in that you know, God allows us to fail and to seek forgiveness. You have to, I've said it before in here, I've been trying to figure out exactly what cheerful mourning is. You know, you have to have that part of you that acknowledges that I really have sinned, and then I go forward and I'm a little closer to where I'm trying to be, not just that act of, okay, I get forgiven and I go on. And
yeah, it's not presumptuous. Yeah, it's not like, oh, it's okay, I'm forgiven, and I can
God,
do it.
Yeah, he got me covered, you know.
Yeah, it's all that Paul talks about, saying, you know, shall we sin that grace may abound? God forbid. You know, we are to put off the old man and put on the new, and all that discussion in Romans 6 is, it's not something that happens one time and you're done. I'm saved. I've walked the aisle, I've been, you know, I've repented, and now I'm moving forward, and now I should always be perfect, and when I'm not, I despair. Well, that's a wrong view. But also it's a wrong view, Barry, I think what you're saying is, it's a wrong view to say, oh, I'm forgiven, no big deal, I can keep going. So, and the... what C.S. Lewis says is, the only fatal thing is to sit down content with anything less than perfection. To not try, to not engage in this spiritual warfare of our flesh warring with our spirit.
And it's also significant at the end when he talks about, you know, animal versus diabolical. I've never really thought of it in that sense. Where, you know, you want to call the animal aspect of it is just like, you know, sinful instinct, you know, physical, just, it's almost like the equivalent of manslaughter versus murder. Mm-hmm. You know, manslaughter is, you know, fever pitch instinct, losing control, as opposed to murder, which is premeditated, devising in advance how you're going to take somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
And the diabolical aspect of these spiritual sins, we are choosing to do them, we are devising these things, they are rooted in a conscious pride or hatred of another.
Mm-hmm. And less based on just our instinct, our sexual instinct,
right.
It's more spiritual. It's more of a willful disobedience and hatred of men and trying to get ahead and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
While
they're both destructive, the diabolical is in so many ways more destructive, and it's also much more common.
Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's trying, I think he's trying to set the context right. I mean, in the circles that we live in, I mean, we're happy to sit in the pew with somebody and hate them and talk about their, you know, sexual sins or their immodesty or their this or that, and we judge them that way, and we put aside the fact that we've been ugly, that we have been, what does he say, backbiting and spoiling sport. I don't know what that is. But, you know, those kind of things. And I think for a young man in particular, who, you know, young men, Barry, I don't know if you were like me, but struggle with sexual instinct for sure. Growing up, you got hormones, you become a man. It's true. You you deal with that. And young men despair with their handling of that and their failures in that area. And to hear what C.S. Lewis says is, look, it's one of other sins, first of all, and ask for help and here's your way out, I think is something that ought to be grabbed onto and giving you hope and set the context right and, you know, go with God.
He gave, that's what he did, I said he forgot. But he gave an example of the, I won't say it was maybe the prostitute that, no, not the prostitute, it was the guy that was going to put himself in position being made fun of by his friends. Even though it wasn't that big a deal to somebody else what he was doing, but for him to accept that position, that what he was doing was showing that, you know, this was more important to me than I did this right as best I could. That was a turn in my life that maybe put him closer to being right than
You're right. I mean, I think of the verse, man looks on the outward appearance, and God looks at the heart. And that guy going to war who's got a psychological problem with being shot at, you can fix that problem and put him out there and say, okay, now I'm moderately cool under fire. And now I can go about my business of looking out for number one and making it look like I'm being heroic. I mean, what you're talking about, he talked about that context again, trying to say, look, there are moral choices and there is fixing the raw material, which is what psychoanalysis and those kind of things do. So, anyway, in both chapters, to me, what comes out clearly is the sanctification process. And sorry we went so long, but I thought these were two important chapters. And next week, if you all aren't tired of this, yes, Christian marriage, and then we'll talk about forgiveness. Okay, Jack, can you close us in prayer?
Father, thank you for this time we've had together. I pray that you will help us to think spiritually and let that drive us in our outward actions as well as our inward thoughts and desires. Father, I pray that you will prepare our hearts and minds for worship this morning. I pray all this in Christ's name. Amen.
Oh, Mr. Bell, I looked up like smiling.